Good afternoon. I'm Jim Weiss, and I represent John Petta and Rachel DeVock in this action. We are the petitioners. Thank you for the opportunity to argue this case. This case arises out of a tragic accident in which Dale Petta was killed by a drunk driver who crossed the center line and killed her. Contrary to most cases where only insurance is involved because of the nature of the drunk driving, both John and Rachel DeVock felt that it was important that they pursue the drunk driver, and the drunk driver was pursued. And the result of that was a settlement in which John and Rachel received the entire policy limit from the drunk driver of $250,000, and then the drunk driver also agreed out of his own pocket to pay $30,000 for a total of $280,000. Practically speaking, that was as much as the drunk driver had available to pay, and that ultimately is the history behind the settlement itself. Dale Petta, more particularly her former husband, who she lived with, Alfred, had a policy of insurance with Travco that insured the vehicle that Dale was in at the time of the accident, and also provided coverage for medical expenses and funeral expenses. Travco was named in the suit as a subrogated party, as was the standard thing in a wrongful death action. It had never been anything other than that, and treated them as a subrogated party, as I always have. Interestingly enough, when it came time and the settlement offers were made and communicated, Travco wrote a letter and indicated that they would not go along with the settlement, and that they would not agree to release their claims, even though they conceded that John and Rachel would not be made whole by this settlement, because their loss of society and companionship claim would be at least the $350,000 plus the additional expenses.
Counselor Ward, John and Rachel ever liable under a segregated claim to Travco to begin with? I mean, isn't the segregated claim the claim an insurance company gets, and when it gets it, it stands in the shoes of the insured. But they're not the insured. So, can you explain to me why they were ever liable?
Sure. I think because subrogation is not a formal legal concept, but rather an equitable concept. I personally, certainly prior to this case, I had no doubt that under the equitable concept of subrogation, that since John and Rachel had the right to assert the claims for the amounts that Travco had paid, that
they didn't have to assert them. Our past case law says, you know, you can assert them, but it doesn't say you have to assert them.
No, that's true, but they have the right to assert them, and once they do assert them, then I think under the principles of equity, that Travco certainly becomes subrogated.
I read your complaint, and I didn't see that they claimed for funeral expenses specifically or for the damage to her car. Did I miss it? Is it in there?
No, although the general notice pleadings of the state no longer require that there be specific pleading for specific elements of damages, and that is not routinely done.
Yeah, well, this, I don't mean by a particular amount. I just mean by an allocation of what you had lost, because this is a wrongful death claim. It's not a general negligence claim. It's a wrongful death claim. So only certain people can bring it, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and you get the money according to statutes. It goes to the person to whom the claim belongs. That's what the statute say. And I'm very confused about why Travco had any right against your client based on subrogation, given that it was standing in the shoes of their mother. Now, if this were a plain old negligence action, I would have a problem. But with wrongful death, I'm having difficulties kind of sorting it out.
Okay, well, let me try to illustrate why I think this case goes to form above substance. There's two ways that this action could be started. In a wrongful death action where there's conscious pain and suffering, then typically both the estate is named and then the personal representative or family members are named, because the claim for conscious pain and suffering is not a claim that is recognizable under the wrongful death statute. In a situation where there is no conscious pain and suffering, and there was none here, then the claim can be asserted by the family members, because you can make any claim for pecuniary loss, you can make any claim for loss of society and companionship, and the statute specifically authorized that claim can be made without a claim being made by the estate. Here, there would have been nothing wrong with, because the statute authorizes it, that a claim be made on behalf of the estate. And had a claim been made on behalf of the estate, it would be an absolutely ordinary subrogated matter. It's hard for me to believe that with subrogation being an equitable doctrine, that the mere fact that the peace was brought in the name of the surviving children, as they have the right to, changes the equities as it relates to subrogation.
Well, it would change the equities as to what they could collect, wouldn't they? If you think they can collect these damages that they've never paid, doesn't the statute limit what they can collect?
No,
funeral expenses?
I'm sorry, I believe that the statute specifically authorizes.
Sure.
Sub 5 says if the personal representative brings the action, which was not the case here.
No.
It was the family member.
No.
So then we go down to the middle of the paragraph.
Right.
It says if a relative brings the action, the relative may recover such medical expenses, funeral expenses, including the cost of a cemetery lot, grave marker, and care of the lot, on behalf of himself or herself, or of any person who has paid or assumed the liability for such expenses.
So you're telling me that you're reading the statute in such a way that you have to, the has paid or assumed liability applies only to, quote, any person. It doesn't apply to all the rest that are listed as an alternative in that section, in that sentence.
I think what the statute says is we don't care who paid for these expenses. The relative, if they bring the claim, has the right to assert those expenses in a suit, which makes complete sense, because certainly what the legislature would not want to do is to give a tortfeasor a free pass with respect to any damages that have been caused in a death action. So the statute says if you as relatives bring this action, you can collect whatever medical or funeral expenses have been incurred here, and you can assert that claim. I think that statute has universally been...
You don't think they have to have paid them in order to assume the claim?
No, I think that they're certainly entitled to assert those claims based upon the statute. And if they do assert them, and an insurance company has paid them, then under equity, the insurance company is subrogated to those rights, and if John and Rachel here, for instance, are not made whole, then they're entitled to collect them.
If I could just finish up, I'm having trouble sorting this out. Maybe I'm making problems for myself, and I see how you're interpreting the statute. You know, if the personal representative had been a part of this action as a plaintiff, I wouldn't have a problem, because I can see where these claims were owned by the personal representative, okay, that they got paid apparently out of the estate, or they would have been paid out of the estate, apparently travel, you know, I guess there wasn't much of an estate to pay for, but they're not in here, and I don't see any allegations in your complaint. It just says an amount sufficient to constitute fair and reasonable compensation for injuries and damages sustained as a result of Dale Pettis' death. I don't see a specific claim for the damage to the automobile or a specific claim for the funeral expenses or for a cemetery lot. And I don't think you have to say a dollar claim. I guess I was just kind of lost. Because when I do summary judgment, I start with the pleadings, and I guess I just didn't see the claim.
Sure. And as I understand it, the law of pleading in this state does not require a specific enumeration of what damages are sought, only the general allegation. And in every one of our complaints, in every case, that language is identical. So by no means should that be considered to be a waiver of the pursuit of any damages which are legally cognizable. And again, let's think about this. There is no question that you can either bring this case on behalf of the estate or bring it by the relatives. The wrongful death statute makes it clear that you can do it either way. Subrogation is an equitable doctrine. Does it really make any sense to say that equities will allow for the insurance company to, or I should say equities would allow for the plaintiffs in this case, if the action is brought by the personal representative, to enforce the made whole rule? But if it's brought on behalf of the estate, if it's brought on behalf of the estate, that you can enforce the made whole rule. But if it's brought on behalf of the personal representative in exactly the same tax situation, that you couldn't. It seems to me that the equitable doctrine of subrogation applies in either event, and that doctrine is the one that was articulated in Schulte, and that is that Travelco has received a premium for the amounts that it has paid, and there's not enough to pay the victims here, which are John and Rachel DeVaugh. And since there's not enough to pay, it's always been the public policy of this court and this state that the insurance company, if somebody has to go unpaid, is the one that goes unpaid since they've received the premium. And to look at this hypotechnically and say that there would be a difference whether this was brought in Dale Pettit's name, as would be permissible under the wrongful death statute, or John and Rachel DeVos' claim, I think raises... It flies in the face of that.
Well, what bothers me is the phrase in the statute that says you can raise the claim on behalf of someone who's paid it. And if you can raise it on behalf of someone who's paid it, and you believe you've raised it in this case, and Travco has paid it, I mean, I have some difficulties with following the remainder of your argument about make whole, because you didn't have to make the claim. You could have pled for the full amount of the wrongful death statute without seeking any funeral expenses or expenses for a burial while there's nothing. You know, they didn't have to be part of your claim.
Well, and if they were not part of our claim, let's say that they weren't part of our claim and weren't asserted, it wouldn't change the made whole rule. The made whole rule it would still apply. John and Rachel still would not have received the entire amount that they were entitled to under the law. And so Travco could not subrogate against them. The unusual thing here is that this harkens back to Blue Cross Blue Shield. Travco wants to say that they control this litigation as a subrogated party. And I believe that the primary problem with the Court of Appeals decision is they completely and utterly failed to make the distinction between a subrogated party, which has rights only by virtue of having paid money on a contract where they promised to pay money, and a primary plaintiff. That's why the last paragraph of the Court of Appeals decision, which talks about a concern that somehow, if there were multiple plaintiffs, that those multiple plaintiffs would race to the courthouse, try to get a settlement from the insurance company, and then eviscerate the rights of all the other plaintiffs, is, frankly, in my judgment, ludicrous. I don't know how that could possibly happen, because there's never been any case law in Wisconsin that says that John and Rachel DeVaugh, or the personal representative of the estate of in the Pettit case, could in any way affect the rights of other plaintiffs.
Mr. Weiss, if I can interrupt you for a minute, you're talking about the Court of Appeals decision, and I want to talk about that also. The Court of Appeals decision, as I read it, is paragraph 15 of the decision, seems to put a lot of emphasis on the idea that there has to be the relationship of insurer and insured, and they're going to the exact language from Schulte and quoting Schulte in that regard. How do you respond to that? It seems to me that's a pretty persuasive argument.
Well, I think the problem with that argument is that, again, subrogation is an equitable concept. And what are the guts of subrogation? The guts of subrogation is when somebody pays a claim, usually under contract when it involves insurance, that somebody else sustained a loss for, and they can go collect on that loss. That's the guts of subrogation. Rhimes says that it's an equitable concept, that it doesn't have any hard and fast rules. And the whole idea with Rhimes is that if you've received a premium to pay under a contract and somebody that is injured is not made whole, then you're the last one in line. So it seems to me, Justice, that to say that you have to have a formal insured relationship in order for this equitable doctrine to apply flies in the face of exactly what Schulte and Leonard and its progeny said.
Can you cite us to any Wisconsin cases that have taken the Rhimes doctrine beyond the relationship between insurer and insured?
I will respond to that, but first let me say that I don't think that that's the situation here, because the intent of the wrongful death statute obviously is that John and Rachel step into the shoes of their mother. And so, for all practical purposes, again, we're looking at an equitable concept, not a strict legal concept. For all practical purposes, they're in exactly the same position as Dale.
Their claim for loss of society and companionship of her. She can't claim for her own loss of society and companionship. This is the claim of another, not the claim of the deceased. I really disagree with you.
Well,
I don't think it's Dale's claim. I know she's dead. It's certainly derivative. But what they're claiming for, and the person to whom the claim belongs, is the loss of society and companionship, support, care, if that's necessary, from the decedent. The decedent can't make that claim as to herself. It's a third party that makes a claim because of the decedent's loss.
Sure, but the claim also contains more than that, because they also have the right under the statute to bring the claim for the medical expenses, to bring the claim for the vehicle. They have the right to bring all of that under the statute.
Could I just
finish my response, because I never get to Justice Crooks's question. In response to your question, I think the classic example, and it's not exactly on point, but I think it shows the attitude of the court, is the Leonard case. Because in the Leonard case, this same kind of what I'm going to call technical defense was raised. They said, well, Schulte only applies to insured situation, and we don't have an insured situation here. We've got something other than an insured situation. And the court, I thought, did a very good job in Leonard of saying, you know, Rhimes is an equitable concept. We're not trying to look very hyper-technically at what the nature of the relationship is. We're looking at the equities, and clearly the fact that, in this case, WPS is not a formal insurance company doesn't matter. We look at the underlying equities. And so I believe that there is case law. In fact, the Court of Appeals, I was very surprised, because we had cited Leonard to them, makes no comment to Leonard at all in its decision. So I apologize, Justice Wilcox, but I wanted to finish the question.
Yeah, I apologize for not letting you finish, but my question, and you somewhat answered it when you answered the question that Justice Roman said, has to do with going back to 895.045 and talking about the funeral expenses and other things. And that the way when we talk about equity, I'm just thinking, in other words, the way you're interpreting this, did the plaintiffs pay for any medical, hospital, or funeral expenses? And my answer would be no, they didn't. But under your concept, then, and as I read this, it says, if a relative or a relative may recover such medical expenses, funeral, including the cost of cemetery lot, on behalf of himself or herself, or any person who has paid or assumed the liability. So what I'm guessing you're saying that this section allows relatives to keep the funds even when somebody else has paid for them, right? I mean, that's a sure.
Well, again, let me try to.
I mean, if we're looking at equity, but that's the way I read your take on this.
Yes, because what I think that this section is trying to do is to avoid the necessity, which clogs up the courts, frankly, of having to file a claim on behalf of the estate. I mean, when you file a claim on behalf of the estate, you got to go bother the probate court. You've got to do a special administration. You have to do a number of things legally in order to assert that claim. That comes up and slows up the legal process. So the standard has always been, and I believe appropriately so, that unless there's conscious pain and suffering, which is the only claim that I believe which is unique to the estate, unless there's conscious pain and suffering, you don't bother the courts with the rest of this. You bring the action on behalf of the relatives. And so, essentially, what Justice Roman said, I think the gist of some of what you're saying, is that if I was standing up here at the end of my case, and this case had gone to trial, and I had gone to prove up the funeral and medical expenses, and those expenses had been paid by Travco, then there'd be a motion to dismiss by the defense. The motion to dismiss being, well, you can't prove those up. You're not authorized to prove those up under the statute. I believe that the language of 895.04 sub 5 tries to make it clear that they don't want you to have to go through to file a claim on behalf of the estate to collect those kinds of damages.
Yes.
That's the way it's always been done, frankly.
Sure.
Let us just assume you got everything you asked for. There was enough insurance and or other funds. That not only covered the non-economic losses, but covered the funeral expenses, medical, etc. Okay. Now, let's just say that's $600,000, right? Will you have to give anything to Travco?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely.
And let us suppose that Travco, that a personal representative sued for its expenses, that's out of pocket, even though it didn't pay for it. And let's assume you sued for the non-economic losses together in the same lawsuit, right? Okay. And now, if we went to the jury would be asked to separate out the damages, I assume.
Yes.
Okay. And so the personal rep would get reimbursed for the funeral expenses, et cetera, right?
Yes.
And you'd get it for the rest, okay?
Yes.
All right. Now we have a situation where you can bring the suit, but you're bringing it on behalf of both the personal representative and yourself, right?
Correct.
And you don't go to the jury, you go to settlement. And the settlement, in effect,